head of the Library of Congress. Like, these are extraordinary moments in our time.
She probably didn't love D.C.
No, but maybe she could. Like, in other words, I don't know.
Jim Billington was the same.
Jim Billington had a role where he was all about sharing some stuff, but he also oversaw the Copyright Office, which is part of the library. And that's just structurally a real challenge to try to be all things to all people in that role.
So, I mean, that nationally, the conversation we should be leading about education writ large.
Yeah.
Is there a team that
we have? Shameful how we just have
communication
stepped up and got command of that.
That's what I think. Because institutions are sometimes shy about it. It might be important to have like a commission or a symposium or a meeting called together where everybody can recognize that if they all step forward, a group can step forward. Because these guys were talking about like not listing grievances, but on the other hand, I don't know that our ecosystem has ever been under such systematic assault by forces that, among others, Larry Kramer at Hewlett has identified the funding of the neoliberal funding mechanisms that have really resulted in basically the dismemberment of standards, regulations, controls, and as a result, truth and objective.
If I can tie two of the ideas that you just talked together.
Do you have another acronym, though?
No.
Okay.
No. I don't know. Maybe this belongs in the Department of Impractical Ideas. But maybe there's a germ in it that becomes practical in somebody else's hands. I don't know. But again, you know, I'm in the purple swan mode, and I want us to shoot for the stars. And Peter was talking about this idea of a pledge. You know, that was what we came up in the Department of the Declaration. People think of the Declaration of a Declaration of Independence, but the operative statement comes at the end, where it says, and to these goals we pledge our lives, our fortunes, and our sacred honor. And then the people signed it. And that was, at the time, you know, what was motivating about that document is it was a commitment to action by the people who put their names on in a way that the British could find them. But they were pledging to take certain actions. And so the idea was, what if we did a convening of knowledge institutions and invited them to pledge, to join a pledge for a new kind of behavior. And one of those behaviors that we just put up on the table as a talk, there could be others considered, would be the pledge that, for example, if a faculty member is going to be newly hired or promoted or tenure or something like that, that they be evaluated in part on their commitment, on their public knowledge commitment, the public knowledge requirement that they're going to adopt these sections of Wikipedia and make sure that they remain, you know, academic, have academic integrity and honesty. And that maybe we can create some kind of a convening that leads to a pledge that reinserts our knowledge institutions into the flow of public information that has been so badly polluted by the academic business model. So those ideas go together, the convening, the necessary convening, the using the convening to create a pledge to action, and then also figuring out in some way what those actions are that, if implemented, restore or reintegrate or viralize truth in ways that are not now possible.
It's a really interesting idea. I wonder about steps we could take to keep this from turning into just reiterating old power structures that we don't want to be perpetuating from the perspective of inclusion.
Yeah.
I want to be thinking about
I heard it's just between what I think I'm still grappling with this whole category of things. But I think I heard a shift between what you were saying about this being about truth. And I got to say, there's part of me not comfortable with characterizing this as liberal conservative. Because while I would characterize myself as a liberal, I'm not sure I'm ready yet to say all conservative thinking is not truth. You know, I think that just is heading down a road that I'm not at all comfortable with. What I heard Cal talking about was behaviors. And I think that's a space that makes a lot of sense, you know, that we will engage in civil discourse, that we will, spend time understanding the facts, that we will engage people we're educating in good information literacy practices. You know, those are the kinds of things I'm very comfortable with talking about and asserting in some kind of a pledge or a document, something along those lines. But, you know, when we start talking about truth and your truth versus my truth versus Nicole's truth, I think we're getting into really not ground I'm comfortable. You know, I'm always happy to debate it and happy to have that conversation, but I don't know. I just don't feel like that's a space that it's appropriate for this conversation to be going.
Because I think then, you know, the conversation never really reaches the audience you want it to reach.
Right.
It just reaches the people who are already designed not to listen to you.
Right.
And then it's just like...
We're preaching to the choir.
So, I mean, one thing, Peter, you said that I've been, and I think we could all agree to this, the national conversation about education is just, it's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, when you talk to parents today about college, they think, my child would get a job, it's too expensive, everybody has mountains of debt. You know, nobody thinks about the actual outcome, why one goes to college. And then you go back to K-12, you know, most people just sit around and maybe complain about teachers and teachers' unions and whatnot. I mean, there's no longer a national conversation about why you want to be an educated society. So,
and that distinction between public and private goods, which I think is,
yes,
keeps starting to bubble up in conversations about open education that I have, but never really rises to the surface. Feels like one that we could tackle a little more head on.
Yeah, I think those are all fair comments. What I gleaned also from my review of our nation's founding documents is but for some reason I felt compelled to read them before I came here today.
coming back to D.C.
was wondering what role we could play in a return to first principles of our country, which are neither conservative nor liberal. The foremost of them being, in our context, the idea of checks and balances. The founders of this country, however imperfect they were, the revolution of their thinking that captured the imagination of generations was the understanding of the imperfection of human nature and the tendency of power to corrupt, and for power, centralized power, to be misused. And the genius, which is also the paralytic nature of our system, is that they deliberately set about creating a system of checks and balances where no individual part of the governance could become, they hoped, so powerful as to overwhelm all of the others. And so now we have this whole new reality, digital reality, internet, and what could we do through some kind of a pledge to a change in behavior which would call America, or maybe even the world, not to a liberal point of view or a conservative point of view, but to an understanding that our nature as human beings is for centralized power to be abused, and to restore an architecture that enables appropriate checks and balances to reassert themselves in a way in which they've been overwhelmed by the way the digital economy has developed. And that maybe there's some kind of a pledge that could be constructed that would restore first principles in the education economy and in the digital economy that could be widely embraced by Americans of all different political persuasions.
I was just going to say, so inspiration is powerful, right? And I think that's what we're talking about. But so is getting action and behavior, because sometimes commitment follows action and not the other way around, right? Sometimes the awareness that you're looking for happens after you get people to engage in behaviors, and then all of a sudden it's, you know, I really believe in this behavior because I just did it. So, I think that this gets to the discussion before about having grassroots and top-down. You really do need both, and you really do need to think, you know, in terms of trust behaviors, how do you begin to develop behaviors and actions that foster trust in the knowledge that's out there, right? And so it may be that you the point that you made about being very careful about who's creating the knowledge and limiting who gets to create it is really a fundamental piece of that, right? Because, you know, in terms of engaging, so it should be beyond the idea of the higher ed instructors contributing to Wikipedia. That's maybe one part of that. But the idea behind that behavior, I mean, we see it all the time in the peer review piece. Once faculty start engaging in peer review, then they become the champions of quality in their own courses and in others. So getting some kind of action around trust, it's hard to talk about trust and truth in terms of a specific behavior, but thinking about ways to do that and to embed that in some ecosystem, I think is going to be really important to this trust piece, because otherwise it can't just be open and it will self-place itself. There's got to be some kind of...
Are you saying only knowledge should track hurricanes?
What's that
right now? Do
you know
should track hurricanes?
How did you know I was stuck? So can I make a plug, like a plug for my education SDGs again? Because what you said was, you said you would like, as your goal, to drive people back towards first principles, right? So pledges are, I have this very, like, you know, I have created pledges, and I have very strange feelings about the actual effectiveness of them in the long run. But like the key part of what you said in that whole sentence, right, is the part about the first principles. And like, I wonder if we couldn't be just more positive and aspirational and just say, we believe that education is an engine of opportunity for all people, period, right? And then have that be the value, right? And so once you adopt a value, you have agreed to sort of structure your program and activities all around them, and it almost doesn't matter who you are. And it could be that, like, I'm not a faculty member, maybe just, I'm just a person, right? I am just a person. I am not any of you in the education administration, right? And so, like when you have people with shared values, they can contribute in whatever context they currently are, right? So if you have a pledge, it sort of limits to certain roles what you can do to influence, right? But what if, like, you created these sets of values and said, this is what we believe as a community, and this is why we believe not just that open education is important, but we believe that education is important. And this is where I'm going to get back. I just feel like, you know, you're right. Like, the conversation around public education these days is so negative, right? And it doesn't have to be, right? Like, we actually believe these things, right? This Thomas Jefferson believed in public education, right, because he... of all of the reasons that we still believe that public education is a public good. I mean, and I think that's the first principle we need to get back to. All of us have influence in the education area in some way or another. Like, what are those shared goals that where, like, open education is a tool for helping us get there and can sort of be the galvanizing thing in our community?
The greatest thing about, like, comparing ourselves to the people who wrote the Declaration of Independence and Thomas Jefferson in particular, whose name comes up, is this, like, Carl Becker writes that the ostensible purpose of the Declaration was to lay before the world the causes which impelled the colonies to separate from Great Britain, and we do in fact find in the Declaration a list or catalog of acts attributed to the king and alleged to have been done by him with the deliberate purpose of establishing over the colonies an absolute tyranny. These causes which the Declaration sets forth are not quite the same as those which a careful student of history, seeking the antecedents of the Revolution, would set forth. The reason is that the framers of the Declaration were not writing history, but making it. Like, and so if that's our charge, like, we can come up with some kind of declaration or set of statements or principles, but in the end, maybe what we're in the business of is making it. Yeah. You know.
I mean, and I think it's okay because, you know, one of the books that I read over the last few years that I just really loved was the Hamilton book because what was interesting to me was that Thomas Jefferson got into some dirty, nasty fights with some of the other founding fathers. Like, they all fought dirty and they disagreed on almost everything. But they were able to agree to commit to certain sort of first principles about what a country is. And that was, that sort of kernel of agreement was enough to galvanized activity. And they also, you know, like their version of the Twitter wars, right? Buying printing presses and newspapers to flame each other. I mean,
and they drink beer every time.
It was
kind of calm.
It was
kind
of
they used to
kind of
they used to have a few before they met.
Thank you for saying what I was trying to say and saying it much better. That's exactly right. And that and that the principle first, the main first principle that I think has been lost in this larger, now I'm not talking about open assessments or OER so much, but in this larger issue of truth and trust in the information economy is the principle that was enshrined and widely agreed upon by the founders of all different persuasions, was that the nature of reality is such that you need a system, an effective system of checks and balances. So that nobody's truth becomes the capital T truth that overwhelms everybody else's truths. And that's what seems to me to be lost right now in the world where there's a Fox truth and an MSNBC truth. And so what role could we play to bring us back to our roots that are widely shared among all different political persuasions, the principal one being checks and balances.
I mean, back to Sharon's point also, you know, a lot of those founding fathers, flawed, let's face it, mostly white dudes, very flawed.
All white dudes.
Oh.
There's a couple in there. Anyway, they spoke to their enemies. They did. They argued, they debated, and they negotiated.
Well, maybe I'm just catching up with you on this one. But what has changed? So they were all nasty to each other. They were flaming each other and all kinds of stuff. I read as a political science major going back and forth in the white these papers that they would kick around. What's changed in my mind is that we've gotten bigger, faster. The media is instantaneous. You know, we've got Twitter, everything else. What was in the middle of that back then that's missing if from the middle of that now? What was the thing, you know, do we turn to NPR, you know, PBS? You know, where's the middle ground in this? And is there something that we can learn from that?
It's a great question. I think the circumstances then are different from the circumstances then.
Sure.
So what's the same is the need for checks and balances. What's different are the forces in play. I think that the founders wanted to, recognizing the fallibility of the human being, to be prone to corruption and abuse of power. They recognized that, and then they set up a decision for communal decision making, for governance, that mediated against the worst angels in our nature. They deliberately paralyzed, set up a deliberately slow and cumbersome for tyrants to exert their rule. And that was the circumstances they were dealing with. How are we going to organize our society so that it proceeds in a way that acknowledges the worst impulses in humanity and doesn't
subjected to us. So now we fast forward a couple of hundred years, and it's media and information that has become wildly unbalanced. And what I detect in Peter's work and the scholarship that Peter has shared with me, which led to this conversation, is the desire to re-inject the still fallible, but the best institution that we have for the determination of what is actually true, which is our academic institutions and our knowledge institutions, to find a way to reinsert them back into the public information flows as a way to rebalance the public information flows so that there's more checks and balances. Not guaranteeing that we're going to have a perfect outcome at every stage, but just that we'll find new ways to viralize truth in ways that aren't possible now.
I mean, it takes 3 years to get something published by the study.
That's why we have to change the way we do it. Like, I think if you somehow count the number of impressions that are foisted upon you, that are of information that are commercially sponsored, like that are coming to you either with a textbook from a privately owned publisher or a STM publisher or a academic scholarly journal or you name it. We've really seeded the whole information marketplace to a whole lot of other forces, and they've been steadily gutting those controls. And I know it's not conservative against liberal, but it has been a radical right agenda to do this kind of thing, funded by Radical Right Foundation, and that's like deeply documented. So it's not necessarily, listen, my wife's family's from Wisconsin, you know, they're much bigger than I am. These people just pummel me, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's not conservative versus liberal, but there's a radical right agenda that's really dismembered a lot of the things that once stabilized our republic.
I'm finding the connection to the core OER, OA, open pedagogy issues a little tenuous. I broadly agree with this problem and the problem of the university within this larger information ecosystem. But I wonder if, I'm having a hard time finding the actionable connection.
Not me.
Well, I wonder if, I'm just trying to think about what it could be, just to throw a few more things onto the table. It seems to me that you could make a case that open education is critical to a larger program of defending the integrity of higher education. From among other things, if you want to go back to founding principles, the corrupting influence of money. I mean, here we have a nice contemporary issue where this is a front in academic battles in multiple places in multiple senses, right? There's the war against kind of predatory publishing. There's the debates around funding the academy. I mean, open education feels like a kind of principled return to academic autonomy and self-governance and defense of the integrity of higher education in general. Those seem to be kind of closer connections to draw than, by no means disconnected, but things that stay closer to some of the starting points of the conversation.